From the Sky News Centre at 6, heavy snow has been causing chaos across parts of the UK. The south and east of England are worst hit, with 8 inches of snow falling in Essex, Sussex and Kent. Many roads are closed and there's been severe disruption to railways and airports. Passenger Steve Riggs is having to stay overnight at Gatwick Airport.
It's not looking good for tomorrow morning, actually. You know, there's quite a bit forecast for tonight, so, you know, one can presume we could be in the same situation tomorrow morning. We'll just have to turn up and see, really.
And forecasters are predicting very heavy snow in southeast and eastern parts of England tonight. Three men who murdered Craig Hodson-Walker during a robbery at a family-run post office in Worcestershire have been sentenced to life. A judge branded them parasitic criminals and said that each serve a minimum of 34 years behind bars. Craig's mother, Judith Hodson-Walker, has spoken outside Birmingham Crown Court.
The main problem is that they're still breathing, so I will still be saying to people, please, will you just ask your MPs, can you reconsider hanging or something, because the deterrents have to be stronger.
A retired police officer is one of two people questioned over allegations that evidence was hidden during the Stephen Lawrence inquiry. The teenager was murdered in a racially motivated attack in South London nearly 17 years ago. No one's ever been convicted of the crime. Leaders representing more than half the world are in the final stages of negotiating a climate change deal in Copenhagen. The latest draft agreement is promising big cuts in carbon emissions from the developed world, but crucially putting back the deadline for a legally binding agreement. The future of a major Michael Jackson tribute concert due to be held in London in June is in doubt. The company organising the show has gone into liquidation. In football, the draw for the last 16 of the Champions League has former Chelsea manager Jose Mourinho going back to Stamford Bridge for the first time with Inter Milan. Meanwhile, David Beckham's AC Milan have been drawn against Manchester United. Arsenal will face Porto. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
It's morning at the Jones House.
Morning, love.
Oh, another day of meetings.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen, younger brother James and Clive the dog head down to get their breakfast.
Phew, something smells down here. There's a horrible smell of gas down here, Mum. Don't flip the switch!
Mrs. Jones calls the National Gas Emergency Service line on 0800 111 999.
Hello, yes, I can smell gas in my house.
Okay, if you can open up your doors and windows to allow some ventilation. Please do not switch on or off any electrical appliances. We will have an engineer with you very shortly.
Well done, James. I didn't know about that switch thingy.
We make a good team, don't we, Clive?
Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call free on 0800 111 999.
Bristol Community FM, 92.2, your voice.
A glorious carnival from a scandal and he just bacchanal. Today we got a glorious carnival we used to sing long ago. Nunios and Puseneo. But today you can hear Calypso on the American radio. Carnival of long ago you used to see half-naked women called the Pisani with shak-shak and vira held in their hand, twisting their body as they left the band. You was not even safe in your own home through the next garden with bottle and stone. But today you can hear our calypso on the American radio. Come on.
of the songsters I can remember was Marlborough and Executor and Black Prince Pharaoh and Dionel Edward the Confessor, whom I knew well. They used to sing Mama Murillo, Captain Baker, Waterworks, Papa Yoko. But today you can hear our calypso on the American radio. Carnival of long ago was terrible. The orgies were reprehensible. In those days women sang calypso, like Sophie Mataloni and Maripo. They used to walk out with Bullife, I mean in the days of the Kanbule. But today you can hear our trainees at calypso on the American radio. A prophet has no honor in his own land. The truth of that proverb I now understand. When you sing calypso in Trinidad, you are a vagabond and everything that's bad. In your native land, you're a hooligan. In New York, you're an artist and a gentleman. For instance, take a lion and me having dinner with Rudy Valley.
There you go, folks. Welcome back to the studio with me, Billy Quain, giving you a quick rundown of what to do for the next few days. Obviously, it's Christmas time, so you'll have quite a lot on your plate, aside from doing what I tell you to do. You just heard the sound of History of Carnival by Attila the Hun, and that's how they celebrate Carnival and Christmas time in Trinidad, or at least that's what they used to do in the 1930s. Now, straight into it. Tomorrow evening at Tewkesbury Abbey, you can go and listen to the Emerald Ensemble doing Schola Cantorum. There you go, Benjamin Nichols. More importantly, on Sunday evening at 2 and 5pm, Sunday afternoon, 2 and 5pm at St. George's on Park Street, off Park Street, it's the Family Christmas Carnival, a dramatised production of The Nutcracker with two actors, dancers and the music of Tchaikovsky. On Monday and Tuesday, also at St. George's, the Emerald Ensemble are taking up residence there almost this week. They're doing the Christmas Spectacular with the City of Bristol Choir on Monday and the Exultate Singers on Tuesday, led by the irrepressible David Ogden. He leads them in the seasonal celebration of songs and music specially chosen for Christmas. And then on Wednesday evening at 7:45pm at St. George's, again, it's the Carnival Band. The Emerald Strings will join the Carnival Band to get you in the Christmas mood. There you go, and that's leading on, segueing beautifully from the Carnival that I've just been telling you about. Tonight and tomorrow night at St. George's, you can join the Bristol Bach Choir to celebrate charismatic new conductor Gavin Carr's first Christmas concerts. It's a joyful mixture of seasonal music and carols, including recent works by Sir John Taverner, Jonathan Dove and Howard Goodall, interspersed with more traditional fare, all leavened with the now-celebrated Bach Choir readings, both thoughtful and humorous. A perfect start to the Christmas season. Clear your own pipes in this magnificent setting and join with the choir in raising the roof in St. George's for the essential Christmas carol experience. Now, I have had some accusations of being a St. George's ophile. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Without wanting to sound unbalanced, we'll go on to Colston Hall. Saturday, 19th of December, it's the Bristol Choral Society. They are doing Handel's Messiah. The Bristol Choral Society present a traditional version of Handel's masterpiece with music from the Baroque Ensemble, Music for a While, in their full and their full magnificent choir. I recommend you go to this. However, it does come with a product warning. Handel's Messiah is 3.5 hours long. Bear that in mind. It is a mammoth piece of work. And when the Alleluia chorus comes along and you think, brilliant, we're near the end, you're not. You've still an hour to go after the Alleluia. Trust me, I've played it. And it you will get quite numb. However, on Thursday, it is New Year's Eve, Thursday, December 31st, the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra are doing a New Year's Eve Viennese concert. It says, welcome in 2010 with a Straussian fest for the ears in our spectacular New Year's celebration with soprano Elise Tynan. who actually I have performed with, would you believe? She's a fabulous performer. Bless her poor old lady. I haven't seen her for years. Now then, we're going to move to theatre. I'm going to get through this as quickly as possible, I promise, because Tony is keen to get his studio back. Knee-High Theatre, in association with the Bristol Old Vic Theatre Company, are doing Hansel and Gretel until the 23rd of January. I recommend you go to see it. However, not as strongly as I recommend you go and see Dick Whittington, which runs Friday, 2 and 7, Saturday, 2 and 7 and Sunday 2 p.m. for the next 3 days. This is Dick Whittington, presented by the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, and that is running at the Redgrave Theatre in Clifton. At the Tobacco Factory, you can go and see Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. This is a Tobacco Factory production in association with Travelling Light Theatre Company, directed by Sally Cookson. It's designed by Kate Sykes, and the composer for this is Benji Bauer. There is a dramaturg ensuring, how should I say, Levantine authenticity with Schudebacher, and it's a great thing. I'm going to see it tomorrow, and also I would like to flag this up for you now well in advance. I am sitting down and having a decent round table theatre and the health of theatre in discussion in Bristol discussion with Ali Robertson of the Tobacco Factory and Simon Godwin, who's the assistant director of the Bristol Old Vic. Tom Morris is unavailable because he's in London at the moment. I am recording that on Monday. It will be played out on Saturday the 9th of January on my Saturday morning show between 10 and 12. So listen out for that one. It promises to be a very, very illuminating hour of radio. If you prefer your theatre of a slightly more amateur slant, then get along to Bath, because Cinderella is being performed by the Bath Unity Players at the Kingswood School Theatre in Lansdowne at 7:15. There are matinees tomorrow and Sunday. You need to go to Bath Unity Players at btinternet.com to get tickets for that. In January, I won't be here to tell you about this, so I'm telling you about it now. It's a New Year party devised by Caroline Harmon and Polly Rollings. Join the Bristol Playgoers at the Newman Hall in Westbury-on-Trim. Westbury-on-Trim, Henley's kind of borders area, to celebrate the start of 2010. If you would like tickets for this, it's 01454413966. I'll repeat that. 01454413966. You see, I could get a job as one of those voiceover things on a speakerphone. Tonight, I'm delighted to report, Bristol's very own Phantom Limb are playing a gig in Fiddler's in Bedminster. Go along and see them. They've just come off a tour supporting Will Young, which is quite a big deal, and they're back in town just in time for Christmas. I really can't recommend them strongly enough, with Yolanda Quarty on vocals and Stu Jackson and Dan Brown of the Robot Club being the main musical drivers behind the operation there. It's well worth seeing. I'd hoped to get one or two of them in the studio, but apparently they're coming down with something. And finally, tonight, the Invisible not finally, because I've got to tell you about the Perian Centre. The Invisible Circus are presenting the world's first, last and only heavy metal acid panto. This is at the Old Fire Station on at Bridewell, right in the centre of town. Silver Street it is, in fact. And it runs all of this weekend. Now, two last things to cover. A Thousand Ways of Light. This is a candlelit Christmas concert at the Church of St. Stephen, which is just off the centre. This is on Sunday the 20th of December between 7:30pm and 9:30pm. It's a free event. Come and enjoy the candlelit concert of sacred music and choral song hosted by the Church of St. Stephen in the heart of Bristol. Chloe Goodchild will be performing with Nicholas Twilley, Masia Mingawa and World Roots Voice. A Thousand Ways of Light offers a glorious evening of anthems of compassion for our time, love songs and devotional chants. So come and be part of a joyous festive evening. Now, I mentioned this to you with special reference that World Roots Voice are one of the four running groups of the Sing Bristol endeavour, which is going to be rolling out over 2010, and the idea is to get 30 community choirs up and running across the city. If you would like to get involved, I will have further dates for you subsequently. The musical director, Hannah Cluen, I have got an interview with, and I will be gleaning an awful lot of subsequent information about this project from her. Go along and see it on Sunday evening, this evening at the Perian Centre, which ties in quite nicely with The exhibition that's running concurrently at the Bristol City Museum at the top of Park Street. There's an opening of Beezer Photographs. Beezer himself is going to be down there tonight. It kind of charts the underground music movement in Bristol in the 80s and early 90s. And at the Pierian Centre this evening from 6pm onwards, it's specialising in the St Paul's images. Now then, Magic Box. Tomorrow evening, David Freese Green, who is the godson, he is the grandson of William Freese Green, who invented cinema. He is presenting the biopic about David Freese Green. It's called The Magic Box, and in which William Freese Green is played by Robert Donat. He is Bristol's own son and the inventor of cinema as we know it. He was the first person to decide to use celluloid to capture moving images, 20 feet of which was done in 1889. He took his new camera, a box about a square foot long with a crank handle, and exposed 20 feet of film in Hyde Park. So there you go. It all started in Bristol. He was apprenticed to Morris Gutenberg at Queen's Road. There is a little blue plaque along there next to the Clifton Health Food Shop if you look very, very carefully for it. That's on tomorrow evening at 7:30pm. You will have to pay £4.50 for that. Beyond that, I'm afraid to say, at the City Museum, you've got the Wildlife Photography Competition, which runs until January the 5th. That is very much well worth going to see. Aside from that, the other free event that's going on, it's Christmas. So get out there and enjoy yourselves. What I can recommend you do most strongly is come back and continue listening to us in the new year. And if the weather stays dry, I had a fabulous walk around town today. It's bitterly cold, but my God, it's beautiful out there. This is the sound of Michael Chapman. Have a great Christmas, everybody.
Michael Chapman with Electric Lady Rag and Billy Quain. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 o'clock here on BCFM with his review of the week's arts around the city. And now, welcoming back to the studio is Matthew Williams and Martin Summers. Matthew, I'd just like to kick off this second part with, if you could just tell us a bit about your, I mean, you already mentioned in the first hour that you're a crop circle maker and what drove you to do it, but can you just give us an example of how you actually make these crop circles?
Well, we design them on paper, and we then scale these things up with measurements, you know, so you either use a ruler, or sometimes we have use computers to design them. It's all about the design. You have to get it right on paper to start with, and we use very simplistic tools. We use obviously a pencil, a compass, a ruler, sometimes a protractor to work out the angles, but we try to simplify it, so it's something that can be done with a compass and a ruler. And the compass represents a person standing in one place in the field, then reeling out a tape measure, which is a surveyor's tape measure. We specifically use those because they don't stretch. If you use rope or twine, then as you pull them out over a long distance, they'll actually move quite a way when you pull them tight, and this can introduce errors into your design. So you use a surveyor's tape measure, and I believe it has fiberglass woven into the plastic, and you can't stretch it, it just goes tight. Now that's very good then, because gives you accuracy. And when you get out there into the field, one person stands in one position, you reel out the tape, and the other person on the other end, when they get to the measured distance, will actually start to walk sideways through the crop, holding the tape taut, and it basically forces you to create a circle. You'll create a perfect circle. Then the ruler that you would have measured on paper, that becomes somebody at one end holding a tape, somebody at the other end holding the tape, and somebody walking along the edge of the tape with the tape against your stomach, as it were, and that creates your straight lines. So when you've actually put your first circle in, you measure around the edges of the circle, points where you'll put posts down, and these posts then allow you to pick out where your straight lines have to go, and it becomes straight lines, circles, triangles, extensions of straight lines. We sometimes have used lasers as well to give you a very accurate straight line into the distance, and the laser is good because it has a compass rose on it, which actually has all the 0 to 360 degrees, and you can sort of work out where you are from that, and you just walk along with the red dot actually on your chest, and you sort of keep it in one place, and you can walk great long straight lines. But I mean, you know, we try to keep things within about 300 foot radius for a lot of circles. Some of the biggest ones have been sort of, you know, 400 or 500 foot diameter, and some of the longest ones, if you, instead of going circular outwards you go long, have been about 1,000 foot long.
Now, one of the claims we hear quite regularly is that, hang on a minute, this crop circle is incredible. No human could have made that crop circle there. Yeah. And I know you were involved in a challenge a few years ago, weren't you, where you said, well, you show me a crop circle that's made by aliens and I'll make it myself. Mm. How did that go?
Well, I've taken up a number of challenges. I've put them out there actually saying, you know, come on, challenge me, because I know we can do these things because we are the ones doing them. You know, there are so many believers that don't want to have their viewpoints changed that they will never take up the challenge. The only people who actually did take up the challenge were a TV company from Japan. They contacted us in the winter, which of course is the wrong time of the year to sort of ask you to do these things, and we said, well, it's winter, there's no crop, and they were like, oh, that's okay, because we'll fly you all the way around the world to New Zealand and we'll do it down there. And I'm like, okay. So we went down to New Zealand, created a crop circle, which was a mimic of one that had appeared, you know, under quote mysterious circumstances. And the reason we can't say specifically we make individual circles is because we get arrested, like I did get arrested. So we have to kind of say, well, this is how you can make circles. We're going to tell you that they are made by people, but we can't say, well, I know that because I made that one.
Okay, so you just tell us also again about the circumstances of your own arrest, because what are you doing? Just normally, do you go in the middle of the night when there's nobody around? Obviously, that helps with the lasers and things like that. Is that what normally happens?
Yes, I mean, we work in the dark. We start about 9:30 to 10. It's usually getting a little bit dark by 10 o'clock, and then we're usually in the field ready to go when it is dark. We have to be a bit careful because there are people watching from the local hillside to see whether anybody's making crop circles in the field. They sometimes have infrared equipment and night vision gear, which is usually pretty rubbish, to be honest, because, you know, we've worked directly beneath these people to challenge, you know, whether or not they can see us. And stories have come out that, it definitely can't be a man-made circle because we were there all night and look, our infrared footage shows nothing. And in fact, when you actually enhance the image, you can kind of see the circle forming and you can kind of see people walking around and they go, well, our infrared equipment is... we won't talk about that then, we'll just sweep that one under the carpet. And so we have actually been caught by these cameras that people have got, and, you know, you don't hear a lot about that. You hear about how it can't be done by humans, you don't hear how it can be done by humans, and there's a definite sort of war on of propaganda by the believers to sort of win it back into their court.
So do you think that there's deliberate disinformation here, or is this just people who are circle makers having a bit of fun, you know, maybe trying, seeing if they can get their circle on the front page of the Sun?
Well, there's no sort of conspiracy. I mean, it's just a bunch of people who have been doing it for so long, they know that their circle will get on the front of the Daily Mail or the Sun. And, you know, the newspapers play this game of one year they'll say that it's people and they'll expose that and they'll do a sort of centre-page spread showing the circle makers. And then the next year they'll come back and they'll do a thing saying, oh, it can't be done by people. And there's this guy said he saw a UFO above there. So it's obviously the Ministry of Defence and blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's like, so they play this hot-cold game of, you know, plug it up, big it up and then rip it down every year.
Okay, you also run something which is called the unofficial RAF Rudlow Manor website. Now, that's not far from where you live. Can you tell us what RAF Rudlow Manor actually is?
Well, RAF Rudlow Manor is a communications centre for the Ministry of Defence. It used to be that they had an underground bomb store in a place called Spring Quarry. It's 25 miles of confirmed underground tunnels, which is quite a large area. You know, if you're thinking driving around 25 miles of tunnels in a car or underground, it's a huge storage space. But they've got a number of different functions. The headquarters of the military communications satellites, which is known as, number 1001 Signals Unit, is based very nearby, and they've got satellites at Cullern Air Base, which is a disused air base but is very well maintained for some strange reason. There's a lot of money goes into the place. It's very much under the radar, so to speak, because they've got bunkers there which were made in the Thatcher era, secret money sort of appropriated to create these bunkers for a joint Army, Air Force and Navy strike control room. And it's to duplicate the functions of many other control rooms around the UK, so if one gets kind of bombed out somewhere else, then they can take over. They don't like talking about this, and they did a pretty good job of convincing everybody that there was nothing there, because they put this little bunker entrance down behind some houses, and there's no sign saying keep out, just a little yellow exclamation mark. And that's supposed to tell you, military base, keep out, no photos, and we will stop you if you come near this bunker entrance. But of course, you could walk down there and you go, oh, what's this? You know, and you walk into the bunker entrance and press the button on the door, and they go, yes, what do you want? And it's like, well, what do you do here? Nothing. Go away. And suddenly the military police swamp in on you, and they say, well, it actually is a military base, and you'll have to leave, and this sort of stuff. So it's all... It's kind of interesting. It's like secret squirrel sort of stuff, you know. They try to play it down, and there is definitely something going on there. I was investigating the UFO role that Rudlow Manor had, because in the 80s they were actually collecting all the UFO reports from the military, and under the, I think it's called Flying Complaints Flight, that's the name of the department, of the Provost and Security Service, which decoded basically means police. That's a big title, but so they're the police that investigate matters in the RAF. They would get all the reports from different RAF bases and even members of the public, you know, because all these things would come through police stations, end up with the MOD. They would be channeled for some reason, and the operative word here is channeled, through Rudlow Manor before they went to the Ministry of Defence in London. Now, Rudlow Manor claimed that they didn't investigate, they just channeled these things to London, and the London office investigated, but government records that we found in the public records office shows that men in black from RAF Rudlow Manor, and they used to identify themselves as coming from the base as well, had actually gone out to interview UFO witnesses, and strangely enough had asked them not to talk about their sightings. So this is why we say men in black, because, you know, people who are dressed in civilian clothing going to UFO witnesses and trying to silence them. It's a little bit like the Men in Black stories, but they didn't have ray guns and they didn't sort of disappear under mysterious circumstances.
Now, a UFO could either be from outer space or it could be some sort of military test machine, couldn't it, of some sort? And, of course, we've got not very far from you down in the road, in just south in Wiltshire, is RAF Boscombe Down, which is the test flying centre for the RAF. So, you know, the obvious corollary there is, well, maybe some of these unidentified flying objects that have been seen around that area are actually military equipment, which... has not been officially announced. Now, I know that the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber were for a long, long time in service with the United States Air Force before it was ever admitted that they existed. And so long as they can keep these types, this type of equipment, out of the media, generally, I mean, it's, you know, some, maybe some members of the public might cite it, but so long as it can be out, kept out of the press, do you think it's fair to say that, that there's a, quite a lot of equipment that the military have access to that that isn't officially, doesn't officially exist at all?
Sure, yes. I mean, the Ministry of Defence are sort of not really developing some of the more exotic aircraft. I think a lot of that goes on in the States, but what will happen is they will fly these aircraft all over the world, and they will test some of them at places like Boscombe Down. There was even a crash of a stealth when the stealth was supposed to be still quite under wraps, and this was covered up. You know,
see, that really is embarrassing, isn't it? If there's something that's not supposed to exist that suddenly crashes, then all of a sudden all the local people will know about it.
And it's very hard with Boscombe Down to keep things secret because it's so close to the road. It's not like Area 51, but then it's supposed to be like Area 51 where they test and evaluate
Area aircraft. 51, that's a massive area, isn't it? It's in Arizona and the US.
Nevada, yes. But yes, they've got lots of things going on in the Salisbury Plain. I mean, they're even testing a massive amount of these unmanned aerial vehicles at the moment. They even had a competition at Imber, I believe, a village, a mock village in Wiltshire, where they were looking for all the best designs of unmanned aerial vehicles. And of course, these things, can some of them can hover. They're like little helicopters, and they're very small. They can be fast-moving. They might look unusual, and people will, you know, misidentify these things as UFOs. I think the Ministry of Defence have to, like all governments, take a serious interest in unknown things in airspace, because it could be other governments testing military hardware and trying to see how far they can get into a foreign territory before they're discovered, or maybe even actually trying to take photos with this equipment.
Do you think that's why maybe that these men in black are out there? It's not that they're doing something, you know, that they're trying to keep something under wraps, that they actually think that this is actually quite an important part of what they do as part of their defence work.
They do have to keep this stuff secret because they don't want the enemy knowing how much they know. They don't want to excite the public, which is why they often ask for people to not discuss it, the matters. But I do think that when you're dealing with very unknown situations where you've got no explanation and they're not military aircraft, they're still interested. They've even come forward recently to say that they're actually closing down the investigation of these things, which to me is just a no way. It's a non-starter. It's like saying, oh, we don't scan the skies anymore for intruding airplanes or ICBM missiles because we're not interested in that sort of stuff anymore. It's just crazy that, you know, of course they're interested. They just don't want the public thinking they're interested.
Okay, so we've had a look at RAF Killearn, at Rudlow Manor, and also at Boscombe Down too. What about the Corsham Computer Centre? What do you know about that? Because that's another place. That's another one of these units which is in between Bath and Chippenham, just off the A4 around the Corsham area.
Yeah, they're all huddled together actually in a very small space on the surface, but they the shafts that you go down, like lift shafts and stairways that you go down to get into the underground bunkers where all these things are operated, you could see all the entrances. It's not like they're hard to spot. You can drive a car, park very close, and actually watch people go into a little building which is actually just a lift shaft, and everything goes on underground. The military have played a big game of trying to say that these bases are closing down. The only ones they're really talking about are Spring Quarry and Copenhagen, which are two sites that they no longer use. But certainly the Caution Computer Centre, which is only created in the 1980s, it's spring-loaded floor supercomputer centre where they have...
spring-loaded floors?
Yes, they have to put the...
Bouncy floors?
Bouncy floors, yes. It's like a dance floor type arrangement where you put large springs underneath the floor so that there's a buoyancy, and if a bomb goes off and the ground actually shakes, then it's not going to actually destroy your computers. They're going to impact. Okay. Yeah. So all this stuff is going on underground. There's people manning these places 24/7. What I find interesting is, why did they channel everything through somewhere that has a command and control capacity? If you've got a place that has radar screens that is looking at the air picture for the whole of the United Kingdom and maybe even into the North Atlantic and Russia, you've got a place like this that is looking at this stuff, and you have all the UFO reports are going through there. Now, the Flying Complaint Flight also investigates low-flying aircraft from the Ministry of Defence itself, so it investigates itself. So they're going to have access to all the information about radar and this, the like. And I think it's just interesting that everything channels through a place that has that function.
Okay, what about this rumour that this is somewhere that the royal family and various other dignitaries will be evacuated to in the case of a nuclear war? First of all, it's if you've only got your sort of 6-minute warning or 3-minute warning or whatever, how on earth are the royal family going to get from London to here in such a short space of time?
I know where you're going with this. There's a conspiracy theory that says that there's a tunnel that runs from Corsham to London. Now, I've spoken to loads of people who work for the Ministry of Defence, and they work down there in the tunnels, actually tunnelling and working in the base. They've all said to me that they've all heard the rumours, but not one of them has ever seen the tunnel that this is supposed to sort of represent. So I think that it's one of those rumours that gets passed around and everybody says, we know it's not real, it doesn't exist. But it may exist, you never know. I mean, it might be so super secret that only a few people actually know it's there.
But it sounds like there's quite a lot going on, so maybe it's more like a regional seat of government or something like that.
Maybe the biggest secret that Corsham has ever has got away with pulling over on people is that there is a deeper level tunnel system and a big bunker there that nobody talks about. It is hyper secret. They managed to keep this stuff secret through the war. They've managed to keep the Caution Computer Centre out of the news. Maybe there's something else there. And of course, if you've got a place that's regularly having vehicles coming and going, you can create extra tunnels and go deeper. They have to have this sort of stuff in case of a nuclear war. I'm sure that the ruling elite and the politicians would go to a place like this, whether it's based at Corsham or not or somewhere else. They have to have it, a deep level tunnel system that would survive a nuclear or biological attack. It isn't the upper levels that we know about. Yes, the royal family would have used those in the time of the war, but it became patently obvious that being 120 feet below the surface, a nuclear strike would take the whole thing out. It has to be way, way down, a lot deeper than that.
Now, on your unofficial RAF Rudlow Manor website, there's quite an interesting little... You've done a section of that, which is a tour, when it's actually pictures of you down in some of these bunkers. Now, are those the bunkers which are very easy to get to, which are open to the public, decommissioned ones?
They're not open to the public, per se. You could get a tour down there if you asked...
Is that what you did?
No, we didn't get permission to go there. I mean, there's not much in life I get permission to do, to be honest, Tony. I just tended to sort of wander along, have a look at the tunnels that we knew. We had maps from caving groups. We availed ourselves of how you'd go down there, what equipment you'd need. A compass is very important. I wouldn't recommend anybody trying to go down there without at least 3 good, long-lasting torches. Some people have been known to get into these tunnels and get lost for, 48 hours, and they're very large tunnel systems. Go down there with either a caving group or if you know what you're doing. But you can actually walk for many miles underground in old Victorian style caves with dripping roofs and get up to the military parts, which start to become the more roadworthy. They've got roads on the other side with tarmac and stuff, and you could see the big doors that actually adjoin from one area into the other. So you can go and see these things if you want to, but it's all been mapped out. We're trying to help people to understand where things are, but there's certainly some sections that we can't get into. We would probably get into a lot of trouble if we tried to get into, but we have on occasions found that certain friendly caving teams seem to have dismantled walls and sort of then we were able to just go through these walls and see what was on the other side, thanks to whoever those mysterious cavers who like taking down walls were.
Now, what about the Freemasons too? Because you've got a whole section of your website, a couple of pages anyway, dedicated to them. How do they? Why are the Freemasons sitting next to these secret underground bases on your website? Is it just something else you're interested in?
I have had a fascination with the secret societies and what they get up to. I feel there's a lot of hypocrisy involved in the language of the Freemasons, in so much as they, if questioned on what they do, they describe themselves as not a secret society, but a society of secrets. And this is like saying, well, I don't actually go out and murder people, but I do go out and murder people. It's like, it's doublespeak. It doesn't make much sense. And when you look beneath the surface of what the Freemasons do, I believe that they are basing themselves on Satanism. Now, that's not to say that I believe in Satanism or I believe in the devil, but I think that these people, their organisation is based on satanic dark principles.
Now, would you think that there'll probably be many Freemasons out there who would totally disagree with you because they're Freemasons themselves, and they say, well, we have nothing to do with that. What are you talking about, Matthew?
Absolutely. That's the whole reason that the Freemasons exist. It's a pyramidal structure whereby the people at the bottom have their level of knowledge, people above them have a different level of knowledge, and when you get to the top ranks, what they know and what they actually are involved in is very different to what the people at the bottom are.
Do you actually have any evidence for that, or is it just a hunch?
Well, go on the Freemasons website and have a look at the symbols which they have there. There's some, I believe they're known as seraphim, which are figures which hold up an arc-type box in the middle, and these two figures either side, they have cloven hooves, red fur on their legs, and they don't have arms, they have wings. Now, to me, that looks like a depiction of Pan or a demonic figure, which you represent the devil looks like. And if you ask most Freemasons, what does that mean? Most of them will say, we don't know what it is. And the few that do will say, oh, it's just seraphim, you know, that's what they are. They don't really know much about it. But, of course, they're all part of an organisation that uses this as their main logo on their website. I mean, I could go into it a lot
further. This is, I think, the United Grand Lodge you're talking about
here.
Which is, I mean, supposed to be, anyway, the centre of world Freemasonry.
Yes, but, I mean, British Freemasonry is split into two, well, world Freemasonry is split into two camps, really. You've got the Blue Lodge, the English Lodge, which has 4 degrees. Then you have the Scottish Lodge, which is supposed to have 33 degrees. And there's, you know, talk about the occult degrees higher than that, you know, which go into, you know, literally sort of Satanism and witchcraft, which are above that. But, I mean, most people wouldn't get to those levels. I mean, George Bush is a 32nd or 33 degree Freemason. I think most...
Sorry, which George Bush? Daddy or the son?
Daddy.
Okay.
Daddy. I mean, his son is member of Skull and Bone Society, which is an Illuminati secret society, which has roots, you know, with the secret societies in the Freemasons, for instance. I think they're all linked, these organisations. They're about... seeing yourself as being different to other people in society and having a different role to play, having a different set of morals, and even though you're a religious person who might come from being a Jewish sort of background or even Hindu, it doesn't matter where you come from, the Freemasons will accept you. But you leave your religion at the door. And then when you step inside the Freemasonic Lodge, you suddenly have to worship a different religion, which is the Freemasons' religion.
But they would say that they embrace all religions.
They do embrace all religions in terms of you can join if you're from any religion, but when you come inside the door, you leave that behind and you worship the grand architect of the universe that is not a single god, he is one of many gods. And the secret name for the grand architect of the universe is Jarbulon, which is a three-way god, which is Jar, which is Jahweh, Baal, which is a Canaanite demon, and On, which is supposed to be representative of Osiris. So that's three gods. So you're worshipping...
So that's an Egyptian god, the last one, isn't it?
Osiris, yeah. So you're worshipping three gods, but say you're a Christian, you know, you're not meant to worship many gods, you're meant to worship one. If you're a Jew, you're supposed to worship one god. You know, it's kind of... So the hypocrisy of this is quite interesting. And Freemasons will say that they do not discuss religion inside the lodge. They're quite clear about this. But then you step inside, the whole framework is based around a religious discussion, and they have a Bible open on the table, which things are sworn upon.
But of course a lot of the initiation rites are reenactments of supposed religious occurrences, some, you know, at least related to instances in the Bible and places like that.
Yes.
Okay, so have you got any plans with your website? Because I know you used to run a magazine called the Truth Seekers magazine. Can you just tell us about that and maybe yes. where that's going if you're thinking about continuing that on into the future?
I've kind of gone away from the magazine idea because we used to produce it on paper, and since the advent of the internet, I realised that, you know, the internet was a much better way to get information out there, and what better way to get information out easily than radio or TV. So I started moving across to doing little pieces on YouTube, which people can look into. And I've actually got, so here we go, symbolism. It's called Truth Seekers 666. is my name on YouTube, so if you want to look me up, I've got a channel. I apologise to anybody who's easily offended. There's a lot of bad language and stuff there, so, you know, only go there if you're 18 or above, please. But, yes, we present stuff on YouTube because it's a lot easier. People digest things a lot easier if they're video documentaries, I think, rather than reading books. I mean, I've certainly stopped reading a lot of books these days, and I get most of my information from video sites myself.
And what was the main aim when you first set up the Truth Seekers magazine?
Well, Truth Seekers Review was a side note to many of the magazines that were out there, which were dealing with UFOs and Fortean Times. But, you know, we dealt with quite hardcore issues. You know, we were sort of prepared to say things like, hey, go and, you know, bunker bust, you know, break into a bunker and go and have a look at it, and this is what you can get up to. I mean, we got into a place called Moncton Farley, and we were actually shot at, you know, when we tried to get out of the place, and we put this in our magazine. You know, this is the type of stuff we used to do. The Ministry of Defence denied that we were shot at. They said that it was a local firework display.
Was it the right time of year?
No, not really. Yeah. So I said there's a party with fireworks going on. It's like, yeah, right, we kick open a door leaving a bunker, set off alarms, and suddenly we've got, like, bang, 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 bang going off behind us. And it's like, my friend who owns a sort of shotgun and regularly, you know, sort of practices with different types of firearms, he said that was definitely automatic weapon and shotgun fire, not sort of firework display. I would agree with that, actually. I think it was a bit sus, but we subsequently got invited to come back in daylight hours, and we got allowed to go down into the same place that we'd been. But what we were trying to prove at the time is the Ministry of Defence said that this place was shut down, there was nothing going on, and it was going to be sold off. And what we did is, by getting in there, we didn't break in, by the way, we basically climbed over a fence, and when we got to the bunker head, which is a lift shaft with a sideways tram that goes down into the ground at about 45 degrees downwards, we actually just walk down the trackway into the underground bits.
I suppose they'd say you broke in because you scaled the fence and got over the top like that.
Well, you can get into Ministry of Defence land by climbing over a fence, and you don't commit any criminal act by doing that. It's if you leave when you're asked to leave, then you wouldn't have caused any criminal damage, unless, of course, they say, oh, you know, you're stretched our fence, Mr. Williams, by stepping on it, you know. But that doesn't really wear, does it, you know? So you can do things and get away with them, as long as you're not sort of doing them for nasty reasons. And what we said back, I don't think this would wash quite so much now, but we were publishing information about how easy it was to get into military bases without being detected, and we proved the point that you could, which was actually showing that these bases should take their security a bit more seriously. We didn't want anybody to get hurt, and we certainly didn't want to get shot ourselves. So.
Okay, of all the various different bases we've been talking about, the one we haven't so far is Portendown. I mean, have you had a look at that one? Because that's a bit further away. That's down near Salisbury, isn't it? That's a chemical biological weapons research centre, isn't it?
I have looked into Portendown, but you really can't get very close to that place at all. I do.
But would you want to? You might catch something nasty.
I do know somebody, a Bristol-based activist, who has actually been underground in Portendown. He managed to get in and look around. He described to me how it works there, and he was never caught. He was never caught, and he got in there. It's alarming in itself to know that that can take place. But I started looking into recently, you know, what Portendown was up to. I found some alarming information that says that it's been privatised, and parts of Portendown have been sold off to foreign nationals, including a Saudi Arabian gentleman who decided that he thought it would be a good idea to sell vaccines to his country. Portendown said, absolutely not, we're not getting involved. No, we're not going to do that. So what he did is he went over to the United States, became an American citizen, bribed off, and it's literally, it's a matter of public record, bribed off some American generals with stocks and shares. They said, okay, you can actually buy our facilities for producing vaccines. And then once he had the approval, you know, by sort of, well, look, I'm doing it anyway, I'm actually producing the vaccines now anyway, he managed to sort of say, well, I can buy Portendown, please. And they said, well, all right, then you can buy Portendown. And they gave access to the live vaccines, the live virus, as well as the vaccine material. And this gentleman's been allowed to produce it. Pretty soon, I mean, I'm not saying that this gentleman had anything to do with this, but pretty soon soon after he'd got access to the live virus material. This was about the time that there was an outbreak scare in the United States with stuff being sent through the post. Now, not a lot of newspapers have picked up on this, but I think there is a story there to say, well, A, you know, why are we selling off the most, you know, dangerous places in the world, where if I tried to scale the fence and get in there, you'd have guards with guns and you'd have, you know, an uproar. Why are they trying to, you know, why are you trying to get in there, Mr. Williams? What are you trying to do? Are you a terrorist? But at the same time, they will sell off to countries that we have had a big question mark about. A lot of people in these countries, you know, possibly being connected with terrorism, and we're selling it and privatising off the most dangerous weapons-making facilities in the world to foreign nationals.
Well, it's effectively, it's putting them out there on the open market, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that national security is something which really shouldn't be available, although, you know, in the whole capitalist world is very much into this whole market system. But that, all these kind of secret and rather dangerous weapons of mass destruction type research is something that should be very, very strictly controlled and not sort of be for sale to the highest bidder, certainly.
Yes, it certainly should be looked at, and I really do think somebody out there should go and have a look into this.
Of course, a lot of this is really shrouded in the most, you know, top secret stuff, so it's very difficult to know actually what is happening with these things. I know when they sold off Kinetic, which is one of the Kinetic wasn't sold off. Kinetic was a privatised version of part of the British Force's research arm. I mean, do you know much about that? Because there's a big Kinetic place down on Salisbury Plain as well, apparently.
Oh, yeah, I know people who work for Kinetic down there doing missile sort of testing and this sort of stuff. I mean, Kinetic is a huge arm. It'll even work outside of the United Kingdom and sell its services to foreign governments to help them, you know. But it's this whole privatisation thing. It's like, oh, well, military isn't really military anymore, and sovereignty isn't sovereignty, and the UK is just a bigger arm of the Europe, sort of Europe. And, you know, it's like, who can pay the biggest money? We'll develop your weapons for you. We'll sell you weaponry. And if you want to get involved in biological warfare, maybe the attitude is we'd rather kind of know you want to do it, sell you the stuff and know what you're up to. You know, maybe Britain is doing that again. You know, they were able to trace, I believe, some of the anthrax virus that was released in the States to a British lab.
I'm listening carefully to what you're saying there. I think any allegations that you make about things like this, you've got to reference them, and no doubt you've probably done that on your website. I think what you're referring to with the anthrax scare is the post 9/11 letters which anthrax was sent out to various politicians, including Tom Daschle, who was the head of the Democrats in the Senate, and six people died. The FBI investigation uncovered that anthrax didn't relate back to Porton Down, but it would definitely come from Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is the US government's secret biological chemical warfare facility. Now, this is all documented. So I ask, leaving aside bigger questions, let's just focus on this one small question for the moment. It's been shown by the FBI that the anthrax attacks in the US that killed six people in the post 9/11 period definitely came from their own weapons laboratory.
And of course, those attacks also virtually shut down Congress at a very important time.
After the attacks, the Congress was then brought in to pass the Patriot Act, which was a huge kind of document, hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and they were all terrified out of their wits, and they all passed the document as written. And I think we've got to be very careful about being. We had a discussion in the first hour about not taking at face value anything that we're told, but without being hostile to what you're saying, Matt, I think that people also shouldn't take what you're saying at face value either. The message should always be to do your own research, to check your own facts. And everybody should do that, whatever the source is, if it's from the government or if it's from an independent investigator, forever. Don't just take people's word for it. You've got to do your own research if you want to have a serious opinion about any of these things.
But the trouble is, most people don't have time or necessarily the resources or expertise to do all that, to do their own research.
No, but we've all got a responsibility to vet our own way of looking at the world, haven't we? I mean, that's why we do rely on to a certain extent on authorities. So we rely upon the authorities, if you like, the government authorities, to be above reproach and to be pursuing things in the right way. But if they're not, then you're in a really dangerous situation. And of course, we could very well be in a situation where the state, the British state, the US state, other states are behaving in ways which are illegal, but we don't know what they're up to. But we should definitely suspect that they might be doing those things, even if they say they aren't.
Well, there's a very good video called The Anthrax War, which I believe has been shown in the United States and Canada, which people should try and have a look at. It features information which hasn't been detailed, I don't think, in the British press very much, about the David Kelly death, and links it to South Africa, which was receiving live vaccines, live viruses. I can't get that mixed up. Check out The Anthrax War. That's a very good one. You can download it on the internet, if not through one of the legal sites, through something that you shouldn't be doing.
Okay, so by way of rounding up this week, we're going over now to speak to, or to hear from, Max Kaiser. He's becoming a bit of a regular here on Friday Drive Time. He's got a Thursday slot every week on the internet and on satellite channel Russia Today. So let's have a listen to the global financial stories he's been looking at this week. And then we'll see what our resident Oxford economist Martin Summers and Matthew have to say.
What about Tony Blair? Now he says he would have invaded Iraq with or without weapons of mass destruction. Tony Blair's a pimp. Tony Blair's a pimp. He's looking for a piece of that defense contractor and weapons cash, y'all. Now remember this. Blair said he was invading Iraq to kill terrorists. Well, at the same time, according to the Guardian newspaper, Saudi Arabia ruler threatened to make it easier for terrorists to attack London unless corruption investigations into their arms deals were halted, according to court documents revealed yesterday. Previously, secret files describe how investigators were told they and Tony Blair faced another 7/7 terrorist attack and the loss of British lives on British streets if they pressed on with their slush fund inquiries. Prince Bandar, the head of the Saudi National Security Council and son of the Crown Prince, was allegedly the man behind the threats to hold back information from Tony Blair about suicide bombers and terrorists. He faces accusations that he himself took more than £1 billion in secret payments from the arms company BAE. Prince Bandar, he be pimping. Yeah, Prince pimping. All right, let's get the rest of the updates with Kaiser Report correspondent Stacey Herbert.
Max, so here's Obama making the case for further wars. And remember, very few people mention the war cost as a reason for the U.S. financial collapse. But the trillions were wasted just as much in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as were in the pits of, you know, the Chicago's Trading Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange. So if you look at this chart, you see that food stamp usage has risen sharply in America. Particularly since 2006, so it's up 40%. 1 in 8 Americans are now using food stamps, and 1 in 4 children.
Right. Now, these food stamps, it's kind of like the electronic version of the soup kitchens, the soup lines back in the Depression, isn't it?
Exactly. And it also puts into context just how almost second world or third world many Americans live as, because, I mean, it's only the equivalent of something like $4 a day that you're living on.
Yeah. Well, in a pimpocracy, you're going to have a lot of people living on food stamps.
Well,
okay, that's Max Kaiser this week on the satellite channel Russia Today. Martin, we'll ask you to start on this one. Well, Prince Bandar, apparently from Saudi Arabia, was threatening the UK, saying that unless they close the investigation into BAE's slush fund, that there may be more terrorist attacks in Britain. I mean, how is he in any position to say things like that?
Well, he's Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia. That's his position, as you pointed out. I think, in actual fact, they wanted to cover up the slush fund stuff with Saudi Arabia because there's plenty of British officials and politicians who've been benefiting from the Saudi connection. And here in Bristol, of course, we've got BAE Industries up in Filton. I mean, a lot of their final demand comes from the Saudi Arabian government. So, you know, this kind of corruption, if you like, is deep in our system. Jobs in Bristol depend upon selling weapons of mass destruction to regimes which are less than democratic, to put it mildly, and we're dragged for, and eventually, of course, you could have some kind of revolution in Saudi Arabia, and all that weaponry will be in the hands of potential enemies of the country, which comes back to the point we were making earlier about privatisation of military industry. I mean, we've really got to get on top of a lot of this stuff. The lies that were told about the Iraq War are being highlighted there.
And what about the point that Max Kaiser was making there about the war being to blame for the recession? Well, he says it's something that you can't say, apparently.
When we were talking earlier about why governments have got no money, there's two reasons. One, they've bailed out the banks, and two, they've been trying to conquer the world. Both very expensive things to do. We might be better concentrating on schools, hospitals, and other things of that nature.
Matthew, do you want the final word on this?
Yeah, he doesn't sound like he's hiding anything, does he? Not at all.
Okay.
He's decided to come clean, hasn't he, Tony?
I do have my tongue firmly implanted in my cheek there, by the way.
Okay, well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, crop circle maker, film producer Matthew Williams, our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers, and the report on the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich's painful divorce came courtesy of Marina Morris. Next week at 5, we have a real Christmas Day special here on BCFM, and the week after, we have Professor David Bellamy, who gives his personal view on the climate change debate. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable holiday.